Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. KY's Whitehead. Folks, I am excited about this segment. We kind of did it as an impromptu segment a couple weeks ago. We had three men on the panel, and we had the men from the Morning Club. We had Larry Lancaster, DJ Boom, Lauren Cornish, and it got so much feedback that we decided to do it again, and we flipped the switch. This time, we have
I'm working on the woman album.
Dre, I can hear someone talking in my ear.
Almost done.
Thank you very much. He'll cut that person off. And so, because we're not taking calls just yet, because in the studio, I have Dee Watkins, a New York Times bestselling author. He is well known around Baltimore City. He was here a couple of weeks ago talking about his new book, We Speak for Ourselves. And so we have him, but we also have the person that he mentors, which is Kondwani Fidel. People know him. He was actually on my show the first week I aired. Kondwani's new book is called Hummingbirds in the Trenches, but he's a poet and a writer. And the two of them also mentor Scott, and I have Scott in the studio as well. Scott is a high school student at Baltimore School for the Arts. He's getting ready to graduate on his way to UCLA to study acting. So hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. I'm good. They all have distinct voices, folks, but I'll help you navigate through. So, Dee Watkins, I'm going to come to you first because I would like you to talk about why this narrative that young brothers from Baltimore City cannot reach their dreams is a lie. Why that's not a correct narrative based upon your own life and the mentoring that you've been doing with Kondwani and Scott.
But there's a lot of success stories that don't really get a chance to get highlighted. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. If you're not in a situation to be exposed to people doing great things or you don't have direct access to them, then you might start to believe that. But, like, I know for, like, a lot of things that I got into as far as, like, the writing and the television and stuff like that, I didn't really always, like, it wasn't a lane for me. I didn't know people who was working in those different fields, and I didn't really get an opportunity to be able to learn from them. So I always told myself that if I ever got a break, I was going to make sure I shared those skills with as many people, not just men, but young women too, as I can, so we can diversify all of these, you know, radio, media, TV, we can diversify all of it and tell those Baltimore stories. And I was fortunate enough to be able to work with a lot of people, including Kondwani and Alfred Valencia Clay, and Kondwani is how I met Scott. And I didn't get a whole lot of time. Connie has worked more, has more of a relationship with Scott than I do, but I've always been inspired by his work. He opened up at my book event and made it tough for me because he tore it down, and then I had to come behind him. So he made it tough for me. But, you know, I thank God, like, these young people, they give me energy and I learn from them, and then they keep the old guy relevant. So it's all love.
Now, what was it for you, Dee? I mean, I know when I was watching a special about you on WBAL, you were talking about how your life could have gone a number of different directions. But there was a moment when things turned for you. Can you talk a little bit about what that moment was? Like, what was it that convinced you to just go to the right instead of the left? And this would have been a whole different story then.
So for me, you know, I would have to say a higher power. Like, it's a combination of God and luck, because some days if I would have made a left turn, I would have walked into something where I could be sitting for 30, 40, 50 years. If I would have went straight, I could have got a big hole in my head. You know what I mean? So it's happened to my friends, and it's happened to people in my family, and a lot of people I care about, and I don't take that stuff lightly. So when I had an opportunity, one, I lost some really close people. Two, I wanted something else for my life, and I didn't really know the answer. So I did what everybody said, go to school. So I went to school, and, like, in that process was where I got, you know, where I found the coldest one ever, and I got the writing and all of that. But I'll say it's just a combination of God and luck and understanding the opportunities that I have, and how even though these are my opportunities, it's my responsibility for trying to build a foundation of that grandfathering system that we was talking about, that you were just talking about when we were in the lobby, that we didn't have. Like, who's going to show me the ropes? Who's going to show me how to agent my agent? Who's going to show me how to get through publishing? Who's going to show me how to not be a clown and play and say too many crazy things on social media? Who's going to show me how to be, because things that'll bite you, who's going to show me how to do these things, or who can I call to do these things? Because there's people in Baltimore, and no disrespect to them, but a lot of them, when they make their money or they have their success, they don't really have a connection to the city, or they forget about people from the city. And you know, I'm not to shed light or try to drag them, but I know for me, I want to be accessible and I want to be that person that I didn't have. And I've been working real hard at that. And it's a lot of young people, some older people too, who I've been working with, and they doing well. Some of them getting agents, some of them might be getting book deals, some of them they doing their thing, and I'm blessed to be able to be that person.
And so, folks, it's this essential idea of mentoring. What does it mean to not just make it on your own, but also to make sure you're doing what 19th century black women said, you are lifting as you climb, that you're making sure that you're taking people along with you. Kandwani, I want to turn to you, kind of the second person in this puzzle here. Mm-hmm. Now, you are new on the scene. But you've been writing for a very long time, writing and performing poetry. You do also a lot of long-form pieces where you talk about Baltimore City. Can you talk about how did you get here? Like, what are the decisions that you made that, for you, you went right instead of, mm-hmm. as Dee said, straight or left?
So kind of, you know, what Dee was saying, I did the next best thing, you know, and that was to go to college, right? Like, it wasn't really too many people to tell me what an HBCU was, what a PWI was, what college was going to be like. They just said, go. This is the next best thing for you. This is what you need to be doing. So I did that, and I went. And, you know, I probably wouldn't have even gotten to college if my grandmother didn't sign a Parent PLUS loan. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying? So, like, I'm going to say first and foremost that my grandmother made several sacrifices for me to get where I am today. Right? She gave me the best that she had to offer. When my mother was pregnant with me, she was working at Signet Bank at the time. I believe it's like now Wells Fargo.
Right.
But she was about to get a promotion, and she quit her job, turned on the promotion, and she started a daycare business so she could work out of her home, take care of me, because she knew that my parents wasn't suitable. And she showed me love the best way she knew how. She kept me fly. Early education, she put me in private school. And we lived right there on Luzerne, down the hill. You get what I'm saying? And she gave me that, and I just always knew to do, quote unquote, the right thing. So I went to college. I did this right thing, right? I didn't even have any real aspirations. Like, I thought I wanted to be a sport agent, but I was just, you know, thrilled by the money and the lifestyle that they live. And I went there, and another person who made sacrifices and showed me crazy love was my professor, Arnold Westbrook. And he saw so much potential in me that I didn't see. He was my English professor, and you know, if I got a B and I deserved an A, like, no, if I got a B, right, he would, like, you know, pull it down to like a C or something like that. You get what I'm saying? To make me work harder. Yeah. And I hated this guy, but he's the reason that made me fall in love with reading and made me fall in love with writing. And he's the person that I am today. So I say all of that to say I took advantage of a few opportunities that aren't awarded to everyone.
Right.
You get what I'm saying? Because I could have easily made that left turn. Because what if my grandmother said, no, I'm not signing no Parent PLUS loan? I probably would have never went to college. Right. I would have been one of those, you know, yeah, I'm going to go next year. And that next year turned into 30 years. You get what I'm saying?
Right.
So, and, you know, I just took advantage of those opportunities. And I fell in love with reading and writing. That was my passion. And I just was like, yo, you never really, you was always okay at everything. Like, I played basketball. I got in. When we was like up by 30 points, down by 30 points. So my you know, my skill level ain't really matter. So when I found something I was good at, I'm like, boy, you all right with this. Like, you gotta get better. So that's when I took advantage. And yeah.
Now, what advice would you give to young brothers? Because I'm listening to you talk about your grandmother, and I'm very mm-hmm. touched by that, particularly coming out of Mother's Day, thinking about the sacrifices that black women have made, no matter if it's your child, your grandchild, nephews, nieces. But what if a young brother doesn't have that? Well, what if they're at this point where they don't have that grandmother who has the credit to get a Parent PLUS loan? Let's be clear, your grandmother had the credit to be able to do that,
exactly.
Because there are a lot of people that don't have that. Right. What would you tell them if they are the guy that comes in at 30 points down, 30, so they're in the middle going, you know, I don't even know what I can do anything. Mm-hmm.
So my thing is, like, I always try to make it clear that I don't really have a one-size-fits-all solution. But even in my book, Hummingbirds in the Trenches, I talk about, you know, I just try to, like, I'm not here to teach, you know, people, you know, not to be racist or not to be, like, I'm trying to teach the people who look like me and that walk the same space. I'm trying to put them on the game or what's going on. Everything you're going through right now is designed for that to be going on right now. You know what I'm saying? So I try to get them to understand that first and foremost, because they might not even see, you know, what I'm doing or what I'm saying is important. So I try to get them to understand why it's important first. And, like, this why you need to find a passion. This why you need to, you know, get educated, not to, you know, pass tests and quizzes and recite monologues. No, this is something that you need in order to succeed in life. You get what I'm saying? And that's what I would tell him. Like, get on to the game and see what, you know, these leaders in Baltimore City are doing to keep you where you are. But this country has been doing for years and years and years without grandparents and our ancestors, and why many of us are still padlocked to poverty. Like, why this is going on? And I feel like once I get them to understand that, then like I can reel them in and be like, okay, what you good at? Right? Like, you good at art? All right, boom. I know people that's making money off art. Let me plug you with these people. You like music? All right, I know a dude, the engineer. He around your same age. Y'all both can try to get it together. You get what I'm saying? Y'all could just build it up. You get what I'm saying? Or whatever people love, I try to get that out of them and try to share resources the best way that I know how. Kind of like what D was saying, like what he did with me and like what I'm trying to do with Scott.
So it's the idea that you, when you talk to young brothers, because that's hard to do. I mean, I want to push a little bit, because that's hard to do. I mean, I go into schools, I work with young people, I talk to them, but the idea of trying to pour into each one of their lives, that is hard work. So how do you make the decision? Because you got to leave a little bit for yourself. So do you, if they have the desire, they have the passion, that's enough for you to want to jump in and help? Like, what does it take to make you make that next step?
So if they have the desire, that's my next move. I jump in and see how I can help. And the people who don't have the desire, I just see how I can support them the best way that I can. You get what I'm saying? Like D said one time, he was like, yo, like if 100 people, he said something like, if 100 people of my close people come to me and ask for $100, I won't be able to do it. Mm-hmm. So if they can hit me up, like, yo, I need somebody to talk to. Yo, can you give me an Uber from here to there? Like this real stuff that go on. You get what I'm saying? Like, yo, bro, let me hold this. Or, yo, you know anybody that's hiring right now? So I try to help them at the level that they at. I'm not going to go to them knowing that they haven't been to school in 3 years. Every conversation not going to be, make sure you go to school, young man. You get what I'm saying? Because now that's, you know, that's disconnecting us. You get what I'm saying? I try to meet them where they at and see how I can help, even for the ones who aren't, they don't have that passion and that drive to, you know, pursue some type of art or do quote-unquote what we call bettering themselves. You get what I'm saying?
Can I jump on that too?
Yes, let me just tell people, if you just join us, folks, this is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. I'm here with Kondwani Fidel. I have D. Watkins. And in just a second, we're going to talk to Scott, who's kind of the third part of this whole program here in terms of brothers mentoring brothers.
So to kind of piggyback off of what Connie was saying, and to answer your question from a different perspective, is we go to schools and we make visits, and that's beautiful, and that's love, and that delivers a certain type of exposure. If I can meet Dr. K. Whitehead, a person who has a radio show, a college professor, a respected published author, a woman in the community, that's a blessing. But there's also like there's different levels to it as well. Yeah. So what I do is I build relationships by making multiple visits to a lot of the same schools.
Oh,
so I'm engaging them in a different way. So I might reference your work. I might reference Connie's work. I might reference, you know, Scott's work or Tarek's work or something like that. But at the same time, I might speak to the same set of students maybe two or three times in one school year, and I'm also engaging with them on social media. So when they hit me up and they ask me questions about my life, about the book, about what else I read outside of my stuff, about whatever, then I'm trying to take that time to answer all the messages and those DMs and all of those emails so that they have like a constant accessibility to a story, to a success story, because that's also something that a lot of us don't have. Like, we see it in our teachers, but to a certain extent, because they're our teachers, they're like authority figures, so they're not like our friends. And we see it in our parents, but they're our parents, so they're not our friends. Yeah. So if you see a guy who's like, yo, I'm from your neighborhood, I know I might look like a dinosaur because I was from there a long time ago, but this is what I went through, this is what I've been through, and this is where I'm at, and this is where I'm trying to go, so I'm still growing with you. If you need me, holler at me. If I miss you, then hit me twice, then I'm going to get back. And that's key, too. So, like, visiting is important, but, like, if you ever, like, if you had, let's just say if you had, like, a school that you really vibe with, like City or Poly, Dunbar, or whatever, that you really like, then maybe, you know, work with a group and go there, like, three or four times in a year, and then it pays dividends in a different way, and it gives them a type of access that a lot of them don't have.
I like that. I like what you said, a constant accessibility to a success story, which leads me kind of to the third part of this narrative, which is why I was so interested when Dee shared it with me. So Scott is a senior at Baltimore School for the Arts. He is on his way to UCLA to be an actor, but he's being mentored by Kundwani. So, Scott, can you just tell us where you are at this point in life and some of the decisions that you made, one, to get you into Baltimore School for the Arts, because everyone wants to know the secret to that, but two, even with your next steps for UCLA. Yes.
All right, so hold up. So, fun fact, I did not get in the first time I auditioned for BSA. I was in Engle after school program, but the first time I auditioned, I got the call back, but I still didn't get in. So I ain't even end up going there until like my sophomore year. And I can't really say it's no secret, because it's a real like small percentage of people that get in.
Yes.
But I'm gonna just say, like, you know, just kind of like stay consistent and make sure you're working on like whatever arts you in. Just make sure you're working on your audition piece every day or as much as possible, just so it can kind of become ingrained in you. And once you get it down to like a certain point, you can get like real specific and real nitpicky. And once you get there, it's like the people that's watching going to notice the intricate things. And that's kind of I kind of had to do that to the next level when I auditioned to get into UCLA, because that was like an even bigger platform and an even bigger place with a people coming from like all over the country. And I think the acceptance rate for there was like 14%. So, you know, it's just.
Well, now we have to go back, because the people are hitting me up and they're like, okay, so we're hearing this wonderful story. I need to know who you are, because we all have to be able to tell people why this is rare. Because the idea is that, you know, for you, as you're talking about it, it's just really your life. But we know here in Baltimore City, when we look at what's happening, we have three generations, if I can say that, D, three generations here of Black men who are successful at different levels. So what is it for you? Because you're reaching a lot of our audience that say, I can't speak to, because I'm like the mom, right? And that D can't speak to, because he calls himself a dinosaur. Connie can't speak to, but you can, because you are a high school senior getting ready to go off to California. You got into a place that very few people get into both times, right? Whether it's Baltimore School for the Arts and then UCLA. What are some of the decisions that you made? How did you get here, Scott?
All right, so I guess we'll be starting from the beginning. you said I'm not allowed to say my last name on air or something like that.
No, I can't, but you can.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, because it'll be under 18, so I got to let you, you know, speak for yourself.
All right, yeah, so if I'm going from the top, my name is Scott Thompson II. I'm 17. And kind of so a lot of the things that led me to where I am is definitely, like, mentorship. Like, my mom's, she would have only allowed me to go so far. But then again, I know a lot of people with good moms that, like, can't always control what their son do. So, like, and I kind of had a weird start in a way, because I started off, not that my family ain't good now or nothing, but I started off very sheltered, very spoiled. Like, my father, he was, like, hood rich for real. So, like, I got whatever I wanted for real.
I like that, hood rich.
I was the little kid. Everybody wanted to go over my house. I had all the new technology and games and stuff like that. So, it was good. You feel me? I ain't have a care in the world. But my pops, he got shot when I was about 11. So, that kind of, like, completely changed the way that I looked at life. Because, I mean, I was still acting, and he was, like, supporting that goal. But like, my dad, he was, like, my best friend. So, like, when he died, I didn't really know what I wanted to do anymore. And that was because, like, he was my role model for what I knew a man was, mm-hmm. and, like, what strength was. So, like, when that kind of got taken away, whatever the verb is.
Taken
away from me. It just messed up my state of mind, and it messed up a lot of my confidence, because the man I was seeing, like, achieving the things he wanted to in life wasn't there for me no more. So from there, it was just a lot of, because I knew I still wanted to act, and I was still getting put in like summer programs, and me and my mom, she had us move to the West Coast for a little bit just so she could get away from all the violence and the energy that my dad getting killed brought. And I was going to art school out there, but it was like, I didn't really know how I wanted to attack certain things. And then one of like the keys to being the person I am is my older brother. His name Will, and he I just wouldn't be here without him, because my dad raised him and like my dad raised him to raise me, for real. Like, kind of like how you talking about it, like how things was passed down between the three of us. That's how my, that's how the men in my family are set up. Like my father, he was the OG, and you know, he raised my brother up, for real, and making sure he knew all the codes and like what it took to be a man, to be a stand-up man. And that's what my brother started doing with me at 13, because I, like I told y'all, I moved to Arizona for a little bit. I moved back to Baltimore, started my eighth grade year. I was 13, and me and my moms, of course, we was kind of like starting fresh at our old, in our old stomping ground. So we had to stay with a friend for a point of time. So my brother, he was just getting in a situation with his girlfriend, and he was like, he just gonna live with me. And so I lived with him for about a year, and I can definitely say like that year changed my life in the way that my life, the direction that my life started going. Because like you were saying, I think everybody faces that point where you can either go right, go left,
right,
or like, or go straight. And I think moving in with my brother was that point for me, because I would have either ended up going left and being kind of like a square, and like that's no dissing to nobody, but that's just that's just not the type of life I'm trying to live. You feel me? I'm smart, but I ain't that. So, or I could have went right. I could have got with the wrong group of people,
right,
and could have ended up doing some things that could have like really been a detriment to my life. So like my brother staring me down the right direction, and like to this day he's the person I talk to every day, the person that like I can always call if I need advice. Like, so I think just the presence of a male figure, even if they're not perfect, just like somebody who'd been right there before and who like know the things you going through, if not exactly, then some version of it, that can just like guide you. Because like without guidance, that's when people gotta learn from their mistakes, and like that's when a lot of the slip ups start to happen, when you just like going through life not knowing what you're doing. So
all right, I'm gonna step in here just for a minute, folks. We're gonna take a quick break. When I come back, I'm gonna ask D. Watkins, Kondwani Fidel, Scott Thompson to tell us in their own words, what does it mean to be a man? And if you had to give advice to the person who's younger than you, what would you tell them? Stay with us. It's Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. We'll talk more after the break. Episode of the Old Boys Network. I got to think of a better name for it. Maybe D. Watkins with all his creativity. Kondwani Fidel. We got an actor up in here. Between the three of them, they can help me out. But we're talking about brothers mentoring brothers. These are three men who are from Baltimore City. Sometimes they moved out, like Scott did, to Arizona for a little while. But they came back. Kondwani went down to Virginia State, came on back to the city. Now he's in the MFA program. Like, these brothers are modeling what it looks like to be mentored, to make some decisions, to have dreams, and to go after fulfilling them. So what does it mean to be a man? D. Watkins, the dinosaur. Let me start with you. That's what he called himself, folks. I'm not making that up. He said that.
Or like, I'm like a house phone. I'm a house phone, too. I'm a dinosaur. I'm a house phone. Or I'm like dial-up internet. My little niece, she calls me Old Man D. It's funny. But for me, because I'm the old man, but for me, being a man is about handling your responsibility and taking care of your family. And I'm not even just talking about in a financial sense. I'm talking about being that person that they need you to be, being that role model, being that father figure, being that husband, that fiance, that brother, that friend is what manhood is about to me. So if I'm talking about like the family structure, like a relationship, the person who you with, they should be able to trust you and understand that you're not going to have them out here looking silly, that if situations get tough, you're going to hold it down, and that you're going to highlight and promote all of the positive things that they're doing. If you guys have an issue, then you're going to talk about it, and you're going to, like, figure out the best way for both of you guys to move forward, and you're going to just constantly just elevate and uplift the people around you. Also, being a man to me is what do you do for your community? What do you do for your peers? What are you trying to set up for the next generation? How are you trying to leave the world, more importantly, your community, better than it was before you got there? Not just taking from it or trying to, like, tell old Baltimore, rough Baltimore, hard up from Baltimore stories. That's cool. That's a real thing. But what are you doing to make that stuff better? Being a man to me, and being a woman to me, there's a lot of similarities when I think about the power dynamic, when I think about sharing love, when I think about receiving love, when I think about being a listener, when I think about being a giver. You know, being a receiver is a thing, too. Some of us are so stubborn we can't receive, but we got to be able to do both. So the duality, I see parallels between the two, but in a nutshell, having respect, showing love, taking care of people, listening, being a friend, being a person who is going to work hard, not just at being the best person you can be, but throwing oops, lifting as you climb, and trying to create opportunities for the people around you so that we can all, like, win and take care of our families and experience love together.
D. Watkins, his book is We Speak for Ourselves. I have Scott here. Scott's 17 years old. He got into both Baltimore School for the Arts. Everybody's talking about that online, by the way, because so many people don't get in. But even more, folks, he auditioned for and got into UCLA, which has like a 14% acceptance rate. First time on the radio, but he's kind of the third part of this mentorship relationship. So you're not yet a man at 17.
Nah.
So when you think about who you want to be when you turn 18, what kind of man do you want to be in this world?
All right, so from the real men that I've grown up around, and like how they've explained to me what a man is, and like what I've seen, like a man is somebody who knows who they are, like from like top to bottom, from like inside and out. And when you, and the advantage of like knowing who you are is you know what your strengths are, and what your weaknesses are, and what you got to do is to, of course, like work your strengths and make them as strong as possible, and make your weaknesses stronger or non-existent, or like something that isn't really seen easily. And then that kind of plays into everything else with how you deal with the people around you. It's because if you know who you are, then like you know that you should be a giving person. And if you know you don't give as much as you can, or as much as you should, then like you know that you can change, that you should change that about yourself. And you know the things that you want to do in life, and you have drive, and you have vision, and you have things of that nature. So you can start to shape the person that you present into the world, because, you know, word of mouth is a thing, and people are going to have different opinions about you. But if you know who you are as a person, then there are only so much opinions that can be truthful, because, you know, can nobody tell you different? And so, yeah, that's my view on that.
That's good. Kondwana, before you answer that, I want to ask you, because the title of your book is Hummingbird in the Trenches, which is fascinating. So can you talk a little bit about the title and then talk about manhood?
Okay, so real quick, I'm going to go all the way back. So I was in New York with Dee and the woman Tracy. She in the publishing world, and they were talking about this book, Medical Apartheid. Whenever I'm in conversation and people mention books, I go bomb. I might hate it, I might love it. So I bought Medical Apartheid, and it's the dark history of experimentations on black people from colonial times to present. And I read it, and I came across this part when it started talking about lead paint poisoning in Baltimore, right? You know, lead paint is something that's popular in Baltimore, right? Like everybody knows one or 10 people that got lead paint poisoning, mm-hmm. people that got lead checks, people that didn't get lead checks. And my belief was always that people just moved into these decrepit homes that had lead paint in it, and that was just like they luck of the draw, right? That's what it was. But after reading Medical Apartheid, I learned that it was an actual study that was done with Kennedy Krieger Institute, mm-hmm. and the landlords in Baltimore City. They would lure these poor black families into these decrepit homes knowing they had high levels of lead in them. They would lure them with food stamps, toys, money, whatever poor families might need, right? So after all of these years of decimating black life, you get what I'm saying? And now you got these kids running around with brain damage, hearing loss. Like, they really don't have it all the way here in order to succeed. Like, I got a friend, right, who has a niece, and she got diagnosed with lead paint some years ago. And, like, when she was younger, like, she used to dig in her pamper and eat her own poop, right? Like, so these are the products of lead paint poison. I'm like, yo, that's crazy, right? And in 2000 or 2001, a judge had ruled with the KKI and the landlords were doing as unconstitutional, and she compared she said, y'all are treating these. She compared it to the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. She said, y'all are treating these black kids in Baltimore like canaries in a mine. And I said, what is canaries in a mine? Yeah. So a quick Google search fixed that. And I realized that, you know, the miners, they used to go into these tunnels and they used to bring canaries with them. And if it was like dangerous gases that they couldn't smell, like carbon monoxide, then the canaries would die. That would be a clear-cut warning for them to either put on some protective respirator gear or for them to just get out of there. And I'm like, that's not cool. Like, I don't think God made these canaries for them to be, you get what I'm saying? Right. I don't think God made these canaries for them to be, to die at the expense of white men in their research. I'm like, nah, you get what I'm saying? And then that's when I came up with hummingbirds in the trenches because, you know, hummingbirds are like some of the slickest birds, right? They can fly up, they can fly down, they can fly forwards, they can fly backwards. You get what I'm saying? They also sing songs. Some people might think that it's irritating, and some people love the way they sound, right? And just like how canaries aren't supposed to be in mines, hummingbirds aren't supposed to be in trenches. But since there's so many of us, it seemed like that's supposed to be the norm. But no, we're not supposed to be living the way that we are. And through essays and poems, I talk about that. And I also share personal accounts of, you know, death and struggle. And I don't only talk about the trauma, but I teach people how and why these troubled realities were created. And I also give hope too, to try to, you know, give gems on, you know, what I learned, you know, in my life and how to get people to better themselves. And it shoots directly to the hearts of the youth. It's being taught in many high schools, middle schools, colleges. People stop me on the street, hit me up on Instagram, tell me how they love my book, how it's the first book that they read cover to cover. And you know, that's what Hummingbirds in the Trenches is.
Now talk about what it means to be a man.
So my first time seeing the motto of what a man was my father. He the first Kondwani. You know what I'm saying? I'm a junior. But I remember when, and of course I put all of this stuff, you know, in perspective now, but I saw it back then. But like my father grew up in the same neighborhood, you know, that I was growing up in, East Baltimore, downhill. So I would be like going to Northeast Market, or I might be going to the market on Milton and Monument, or I might be going anywhere to Patterson Park, and I would really just like run into my father, like on like some regular day, like, yo, what's up? You get what I'm saying? And like, I might hit him up, and I might be like, yo, daddy, you got $20 so I can grab something to eat, or you got $10 so I can get this. And if he had it, he would give it to me. And if he didn't, he would say, where you gonna be at in the next hour? And he would meet me wherever I say I'm going to be, and he would bring me whatever it is that I asked for. If he had to take it from somebody, if he had to borrow from somebody, if he had to, you know, hustle to get it, he made sure he did that. And that kind of sums up what I believe a man should do. You get what I'm saying? You identify a problem, you identify a need in your family or amongst someone that you love, and you go get that. You get what I'm saying? And as, you know, being on this journey, you know, I learned that, you know, that my family didn't really have any heirlooms or legacy, right? Opposed to like, oh, this was your grandmother's favorite recipe, or like, this was your grandfather used to listen to. You get what I'm saying? I'm like, okay, so how can I do something different that will help benefit me, this family, our legacy? And that's becoming a published author. That's, you know, me getting as many degrees as I can, me covering as much ground as I can while I'm here, because it's so much bigger than me. I can't take none of this stuff when I go. But I got 7 younger siblings. Rest in peace to one of them. You get what I'm saying? So I'm covering all this ground for them so they can be like, okay, my big brother did this, my big brother did that, so they can have something to aspire to, right? Like, I'm the first man in my family to get a degree. You get what I'm saying? Like, and I don't want to be the last. So I'm like, I got to just keep going and going and going until my bones crawl cold. You get what I'm saying? And also another thing that I can say that I learned from my father and being a man is that, like, a lot of things that my father did, he never exposed me to that. Like, I had to find out through other people as I got older. Like, I didn't know that my father was on drugs. I didn't know that my father, like, you know, was, you know, he hurt people in his life. Like, I never knew that until I got older, and I appreciate him for keeping me away from that and always teaching me to respect women and always teaching me to respect my grandmother and always teaching me to respect my mother no matter what her circumstances was. And he taught me the value of loving your family. Like, he loved anybody with the last name Russell or anybody that's like connected to him, and it's scary. You know, I live in a world, in a body where like you pick and choose your family and your friends. That's just what it is. But him, no, if you got the same name as him, the same, you know, you affiliated with him, he gonna look out for you. If anybody got a problem, you answer to him. And I can honestly say that, you know, as I got older, I also realized that's probably why, you know, I probably didn't really face, you know, the average altercations that a person would face growing up, because my father set that. He set that legacy. He set that, like, y'all ain't gonna play with mine as long as I'm living. Even if I'm in prison, you get what I'm saying? Y'all already know better. That's like some crazy fear that he had instilled in people. And I seen that a lot. And I look back and I see it. You get what I'm saying? So to sum everything up, I would say loving your family, your friends, the people that's close to you, and looking out for them, you know, when they ask you to do something, though, even if they don't ask, if you see ways that you can help and you can benefit your family in the present and also in the long run, do that.
Wow. So, Dee, I'm coming back to you. I can see why you took on Kondwani to mentor, because I appreciate that. The hummingbirds in the trenches is powerful.
He's polished. He's polished.
But your buddy's polished. I can see that degree, the second degree, already working through you, because I didn't even – I mean, I used to think about canaries in the minefield, but the idea of just the way you put it, I don't think God put canaries here to die at the expense of white men doing research. That's powerful to me. So, Dee, let me talk about Baltimore. And I'm going to ask all of you, because there's so many narratives being written about Baltimore City right now. I mean, I won't bore you by going through all the national stories we've had since the Baltimore uprising, right?
It's a long list.
I mean, we could just gun trace task for Detective Souter, our baby sitting in the cold, you know, Mayor Pugh, we have D'Souza in jail, Mary Bubala. Like, we could just keep
going viral for something goofy.
We're back. There's an op-ed about Baltimore City in the New York Times today. Written by Baynard about how Baltimore cops are what, bad guys with guns? I mean, it's like, come on. Every time you turn around, and the last 3 weeks, look at how much has happened from the FBI to the IRS. I tell people I'm not going to be too happy if the feds show up. I won't be scared if the IRS shows up. Like, that's when I get scared. Because, I mean, I think if they start looking, they're going to find something that you missed from maybe 10 years ago, and it's going to bring you down. But that's where Baltimore City is in terms of the national narrative. As three brothers that know about Baltimore City from different perspectives, I'm going to start with you, Dee. Can you tell me what you love about this city? And if somebody asked you to describe Baltimore, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that what I love about the city the most is the resiliency of the people, of the citizens here. In Baltimore, resiliency is currency. Like, it's extremely valuable. And it's helped me navigate through all of the different worlds that I work in today. I wouldn't be who I was in the publishing world. I wouldn't be able to have confidence in dealing with things that are happening in television. I wouldn't have confidence in speaking in front of all types of different people if I wasn't from Baltimore City. So I'm extremely thankful for that. To put it in context, my first day teaching, when I was an adjunct professor at Coppin State University, and I remember being in a room running off papers of my syllabus, and I was just so happy to be an adjunct professor. Like, yo, somebody's actually gonna help me teach. Like, wow. And this is like one of the best days of my life, because I'm from the bottom. Like, I never met a college professor like that. Like, they wasn't walking up and down Ashland Avenue. So that was beautiful for me. And this is my first day. So I remember I went to the thrift store and bought like a jacket, like a tweed coat. Don't laugh at me. I went to the thrift store and bought like a tweed coat to sleep. Y'all can't see me. Well, Facebook can. It stopped like right here because I got long arms. But, you know, I wore it on campus, and I'm in a room and I'm running off papers, and this dude comes in and he's fussing. And he was a professor. He's not at the school anymore. But at the time, he was still at Coppin, and he's fussing and he's angry, and he's looking at me, and he was like, "Who are you?" And I'm like, "Oh, how you doing, sir? I adjunct here now." "Oh, yeah, what do they got you teaching?" And I said, "English 101. And he was like, oh my God, those students are horrible. This school is horrible. Everything's horrible." Like, yeah, every day. He said, "Every day for you is going to be a bad day."
Wow.
So I turned around, I looked at him, and I said, no, this isn't a bad day. This is a part-time job. For me, a gun in your mouth is a bad day. This is something good. This is something positive. And then he tried to clean it up, and I was like, check this out, Slim. Don't say nothing else to me. And I never talked to him again. So I'm at Coppin for a while, and my articles started coming out. And when my articles started coming out, the same guys running down the hallway like, oh, my God, D. Watkins, I just read you. It's something, something. I heard you was on HuffPost Live and yada, 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 yada. And I'm like, the only thing that stuck in my mind is, like, this person doesn't love the students. He doesn't love these kids. And he's, like, giving his toxic energy and his negativity to, I don't know how long he was at the school, but I know he was probably there long enough to mess up the lives of a lot of potential Scots and potential Connies and people who could have fell in love with writing. Maybe me. If he was my teacher when I had English 101, I probably, you know, would have felt the negative way about writing still. So, you know, that's why it's really, really important for me to teach in Baltimore. And that's why I love Baltimore so much, because, you know, I'm at University of Baltimore now and I have some amazing students. And when I was at Coppin, you know, both schools are commuter schools where people from the city really want to better themselves and get educations. And they have real stories and they're talented and they have passion and rapture when they speak. And I see that talent and I see that resiliency that that has taken me where I am. So, you know, that's Baltimore for me. And if you're not in it, then you shouldn't really. When people who write about Baltimore, but they're not in Baltimore, I can just tell. Like, I can just tell. It don't hit the same. It don't hit the same when you in New York. It don't hit the same when you in another country. Like, it ain't the same. It's not the same vibe. It's not the same energy, and you don't feel it. And it's crazy because we are, like, we talking about this. Like, and I'm talking about, like, we some regular dudes, but, like, we really read. Like, me, Kondwani, and Jason Reynolds, New York Times best-selling National Book Award winning Jason Reynolds, was fussing about James Baldwin in the end of the night, in the middle of a nightclub. Everybody's in D.C. dancing, turning up. We fussing. Like, we sitting there, like, really picking apart lines and passages and captures. So we love the city. And, again, you can't love that hard without the resiliency from being from here. You can't think that hard. You can't be that hard. You can't use that hardness and turn it into, like, a force of love that's unstoppable that allows us to still be relevant in our communities, because we can all go on pretty much any block and where we come from or where we live at and take those same skills on the road with that same love and that same positive energy and really impact, change, and make difference. So that's my city, and that's why I'm stuck here. Like, I'm gonna be here until, like I said, the only thing to get me out of Baltimore is if somebody smacked me with a $20 million check. Then I'm like, yo, I'm gonna move for a minute. I'm gonna come build some schools. You know what I'm saying? And then I'm coming back home anyway.
It's so interesting because I'm thinking about you, Dee, because I remember, and this is years ago, which you may not remember, but when you met my sons when they were much smaller, before this was, I don't even know when it was, around the Baltimore Uprising time, and you were just talking to them, and you were talking to them about school, and you were like, your mom is dope, you should listen to her. I always bring that up. I'm like, there are people who told you, but that you spoke wisdom, because sometimes you actually don't know when you're impacting people. When my son saw you on Saturday at Strong City, Baltimore, like, he's like, I got to go over and tell him I'm going to college, because he wanted to just kind of thank you in so many ways.
I remember when you wrote the article about the B-side and the sun, and I was like, oh, God, I got to tell Dr. Whitehead. I'm optimistic. I know I can feel pretty dark with my pen. I'm not as dark as Connie, but I can be pretty dark with my pen, but I'm optimistic, too.
I appreciate that.
So proud of your sons. Like, they doing their thing. That's love. That's what it's about.
That's what I was thinking. I was so excited with Scott, because Scott, like my oldest son, is on his way to college. And what I'm thinking about, Scott, when you leave out of here, and this is what my son is struggling with, right? Because he's getting ready to go down to Tennessee. And he said, when people say you're from Baltimore, they kind of pull back a little bit because of their narrative about Baltimore City. And here's a young brother in this different place. What is the narrative about Baltimore City? When you get to California and people approach you and you say, you're from B-more, you're from Baltimore. I know we don't say B-more, from Baltimore. What would you tell them about this city?
All right, so We definitely get a bad rep from, like, everybody. I didn't went to Arizona. I didn't just, like, travel to different cities just for, like, something or whatever. And every time I say where I'm from, it's always, like, a little something that, like, get people, I don't know, shook or whatever. But I think the best thing about growing up here, and I don't know if it was just because I was blessed to, you know, have met the right people in my life, but it's the energy. Kind of going off of what D. Watkins was saying, like, this city is really raw, and, like, that's what I love about it the most. Like D was saying, and Kong can relate to this, I can get real dark with my pen as well, just because, like, the circumstance that I was put in with my dad, just because, like, I know the effects that violence in this city and that the type of environments that, like, children and, like, people are put in, that's like, often what I write about, just because that's, like, I feel like even though people hear about the dark side of the city, they don't hear about why it's this way and, like, the things that cause it to be this way. Because it's, like, it's not like we all born, like, evil people. Like, Baltimore, Baltimore isn't hell. Like, we not getting raised by Satan and his disciples or nothing like that. And, like, it's just the way some certain situations and certain circumstances can make you. But we lit over here. Like, I can go almost anywhere, and it's just like it could be like some music playing. It can be just some kids like chilling on a playground. Like, I don't know. It's just it's always seemed to even when like something. If you in a bad situation, I've always, like, been around people and seen people that because we grow up in stuff that's bad, we know how to make the best of it. Like I'm not a big fan of, like, watching, like, and recording fights and stuff like that. But, like, if people was, like, constantly fighting and stuff like that, and we might occasionally, like, get a laugh out of it or something, like, as long as... You know, ain't nobody, like, really get seriously hurt or anybody get killed or anything. I just think it's fun. You know, like, brush your shoulders off. Y'all dap each other up. It was a good fight. Like, and just keep it moving. Like, I feel like the rough nature isn't always a bad thing if you know how, like, navigate your way through it and, like, find a way to still become a positive person. Because, like, positive energy in negative situations, like, I feel like can kind of be a perfect mix at some point. Because there's people that grew up in stuff that's too positive. And they soft, like, they don't really know about the hardships in life. And, like, even if they, like, I'm not a person who went through a lot of the things a lot of my friends went through, but I seen them go through it and I paid attention. Mm-hmm. And, like, I have, like, relatives and, like, people, like, my ancestors that went through these things for me and was able, like, I was allotted just to be able to hear the story. So I know, like, what not to do and what to stay away from. But I know what's going on. Like, I'm not stupid. And I'm like, I'm prepared for it. But yeah, I think, like, my narrative of Baltimore is just like the city that's cool against all odds. Like, mm-hmm. that's kind of
like that.
That's my narrative of Baltimore.
Cool,
like,
against all odds.
We lit against all odds. Like,
I like that. Well, I'm gonna come to you, Kondwani. Now, where you are, I kind of see you as a middle child here, yeah, between Scott, the baby brother, and D. Watkins, the dinosaur, which, again, folks, that's what he called himself. but if you look back, Kondwani, I want you to go about 50 years into the future. Mm-hmm. And how do you want people to remember this time in your life? And when they talk about Kondwani and the work you did, what do you want them to say about what you were trying to do and how you accomplished it?
One of the things that I'm going to always go back to is the scene in Fences when Rose was telling her son, you know, why he shouldn't be upset at the father, Troy, who passed away because the son didn't want to go to the funeral. And Rose said, you know, your father hugs, and sometimes when he hugs, it hurts. He showed you love the best way that he knew how. So I want people to look back at my life and say, okay, this kid was just trying to help out the best way that he knew how with what he had. He gave the best that he had to offer, and that's skills and resources and plugs, using literacy as the vehicle, using spoken word as the vehicle, using art as the vehicle. So that's what I want people to look back on my life and say, like, you know, this kid was really just doing what he thought was right at the moment. I could be doing all of the wrong thing. Who knows, right? Like, I could get all the way to the end of the row and be like, you went the wrong way. But they can't. I just want people to see that, you know, through my work, through people vouching for me, through what's on record. You get what I'm saying? And like you'll be able to see who really cared about Baltimore and not just talk about Baltimore from these foreign places, but like who really cared about the students, who the students really connected to, who the people really connected to. That's what I care about.
Folks, this has been an amazing time. I want to thank D. Watkins. D. Watkins is a New York Times bestselling author. He's a college professor down at the University of Baltimore. He knows how to write. I mean, he's wicked with his pen. He can be dark sometimes.
I'll be trying.
But he has a little bit of optimism that he comes up with. And so I just want to tell you, D., I appreciate you. And really, I will just speak on behalf of parents in this city. Thank you for just leaning in to our children and not just modeling for them what it means to write and to love this city, but also showing up and doing the hard work. Thank you so much, D. Watkins.
Thank you.
We have Scott here. Scott is on his way to college. Scott is a mom getting ready to send another senior off to college. I want to say I'm with you. I stand with you. And we here in Baltimore City, we're behind you. We want you to succeed because when you succeed, we all succeed. So thank you, Scott, for joining me.
No problem.
And Kondwani, little brother here, I appreciate you, and I appreciate what you teach and what you talk about. And I was taking notes, actually, as you were writing, because, I mean, you're wicked with your pen as well. A little bit darker than D. Walkins, definitely much darker than I am, because I got to stay positive
here. You're talking about bad days gunning them off.
Bad days gunning them off. You're talking about hummingbirds in the trench. I mean, when you laid that down for Medical Apartheid, a book that I loved and read, broke it down. So thank you. And if you get to the end of the road and they tell you you went the wrong way, at least you went the wrong way real strong, and we appreciate that.
Most definitely.
Folks, this is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Join us tomorrow. We're going to have another show talking about conversations that matter. And for us on this show, nothing matters more than lifting up black men at all stages of their life, from the dinosaurs to the babies. We appreciate them. Stay with us, because coming up next is For the Culture with Faraji. And remember what Angela Davis said, folks. I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I'm changing the things I cannot accept. I look forward to speaking with you tomorrow.